A human experience somewhere on a dark country road is by any means a real human experience, no matter how it's perceived by the person present. The videos leaked by government officials are only copies of experience, digitalized versions of events that can never be as real as someone actually telling about them. The stories told by fighter pilots are in these cases of importance, even if they're conditioned by their background, enemy or not enemy, threat or not threat. It's not the underlying experience of being human in a mysterious, almost mystic and profound situation. I'm generalizing a bit, as I'm sure even the most hardcore, tough, and patriotic officials can have profound experiences, but the involvement of those higher up on the ladder of power will always lurk in the shadows. That's why I'm always coming back to the personal, non-official, and intimate experiences of people like you and me. In Sweden, a traditionally very secular country, this is unique, especially when it comes to those cases with a high strangeness factor. I can't say what Cal, Nut, Jorgen, Ulrika, Lillianne, Rune, Ant, Benny, Jan, and the others really experienced. I'm not the one to judge. One can speculate, but judgment doesn't belong here. What I'll always do, as always when I've been researching unexplained phenomena, is to accept and respect the stories being told. In my humble opinion, their personal experience is always more important than physical proof and thorough investigations. What I do believe, though, is that something is flying around up there, things that come knocking on the door with gifts and want to play a game of mischief. Imagine you're underwater, swimming among coral reefs or maybe in a pool somewhere. You're almost levitating down there, and all is calm. The water is embracing you. And if it weren't for us humans missing the important physical and biological talent of breathing during those conditions, it would seem completely normal, like up on dry ground. I see the phenomenon like that. It's always around, but we're not completely comfortable with it because of how we are constructed. I tend to see the concept of it all as a natural phenomenon. Just like everything else in our nature, it exists to challenge us. It wakes us up when life becomes routine. It makes us challenge our belief system. It teases us. It makes us come alive, no matter what it is. Let's put UFOs under an umbrella together with Bigfoot, ghosts, psychic powers, and other kinds of unexplained mysteries. It's all the same, just with different appearances depending on who's studying it. As stated above, the observer is the observed. We're looking at ourselves, and ourselves are looking back at us. What we see is a dreamlike reflection of our own past, a perception viewed through the experiences and information we've consciously or unconsciously received since we were born. It doesn't mean it's not true. It's a reality of its own. Like water, earth, fire, and air, there's another, partly unseen element that some of us see, but everyone, in one way or another, interacts with. The medieval science and ancients called it aether. The chaos magicians say it's one of the five directions of the pentagram, the material that fills the region of the universe beyond the terrestrial sphere. In that element, everything can happen, and all kinds of experiences can be produced, always in connection with our consciousness, even physical in parts. It is a mystery, a riddle that we might never solve. Maybe it's for the best. My ghosties, my ghoulies, and my moth people. Welcome to Noctivagant, the show about the strange, paranormal, otherworldly, and the people who write books about it. My name is Rory, and I am joined by the Western capitalistic dogs, Nick and Jay.
I'm a dog.
I just really like money, okay?
And on this show, we are going to discuss, dissect, and review the best and worst in the world of paranormal and conspiracy literature. So settle in, buckle up, and prepare for a walk on the midnight roads of Noctivagant.
And throw the stick, damn it!
And I guess we're back again.
Yeah.
Yay!
Part two of Northern Lights, High Strangers in Sweden by Fred Anderson. There, I introduced the book before we ramble for 20 minutes.
Before we?
Yeah, we.
Hmm.
You don't have to rise to my bait. Good. Really, it's your
Good
fault.
Job.
Oh, yeah.
Good job. Good job. Okay. Just watch. We'll get you a pumpkin full of meat.
Ah, good. You, just like my wife, scheduling my enrichment.
It's the only way we can get you there on time.
Yeah.
We got to give you anxiety, and that's how we do it.
Oh, that's why I'm a mess.
That's at least one of the reasons. That and, you know, you live in America. Whoa.
I still love money.
It's hard not to when you're bred to. Well, anyway, so without further ado, do we just want to jump right back in?
Yes. Yeah, I'm ready to dive back into those frigid Swedish waters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
More boxes.
More furry boxes.
Yeah, I don't think...
That sounds bad.
Yes, it does. So on that note... Part four.
I tried so hard this time, too.
Obviously not hard enough. Part four. Maybe it was them all along. There's this stereotype around Swedish people that they struggle to accept gifts. It's a facet of their culture which Fred wonders might be rooted in their earliest folklore. And maybe aspects of that come from encounters with the anomalous. On December 3rd, 1979... Lillianne Carlson was unable to sleep, so she got up for a walk in a nearby recreational area and forest whose name I cannot even fathom to pronounce even after listening to it 13 times. After walking for a time, she felt a strange presence and then saw an oval-shaped craft hovering before her. As she watched the craft and felt watched in return, two figures emerged from behind the craft. They were human-sized, but very thin, wearing tight, white, silk-like clothing, and she couldn't make out their facial characteristics. She sensed that they were talking about her, and after receiving a telepathic message to not be afraid, felt that they were laughing at her. They levitated toward her, and one of them offered her something that looked like a chocolate bar. She felt paralyzed and couldn't reach for it. After a few minutes, the beings, without a word, turned back to the craft, walking behind it, and then the object vanished. Lillianne ran crying back to her apartment where she told her story to her friend and brother. 2 days later, investigators went out to where she had seen the crash, but there was no evidence that anything had been there. Fred wonders if her inability to take the candy was some sort of ancestral memory. Maybe it was, but either way, I think it's good instincts on her part. If we aren't supposed to take candy from strangers, we certainly shouldn't take them from non-human beings who seem to be having a laugh at our expense prior to offering us a candy bar, of all things. No lanulosin chocolate, please.
Those smug bastards.
This also very seriously reminded me of the idea of people going to a nature preserve and being like, we're not supposed to feed it. It's like, okay, nobody's looking. They like chocolate, right? It doesn't hurt them.
I really don't like the idea of us being a planet of, like a zoo planet. It makes me deeply uncomfortable.
I know.
Like, justifiably, still funny.
Yeah. Jokes aside, food plus non-human intelligence seems to be a common thread around the world. In Joshua Cutchin's A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch, they discuss an incident from 1971 France where witness Paul de Brescia had a similar experience to Lillianne's. He accepted the chocolate gift and instantly fell asleep. He then woke in his apartment days later. In 1974, another case out of France featured a man who was given chocolate. These beings, however, just watched him eat it and then left. In Sweden, Fred could only find one other case that was similar to Lillianne's, that being the case of Auntie Johnson. Auntie was a contactee and had been since an incident in 1984 that we'll discuss in a future bit. In 1989, he co-wrote a book in which he details his journeys across the universe with his new alien friends. To take these trips, they would make him drink a special liquid that looked like gray, heavily diluted milk, that was bland and a little sweet and makes me want to vomit.
It sounds really, really gross. I feel like I would have been like, look, guys, I want to go into space, but I can't physically make myself drink this.
Yeah, it makes me think of like the drink that you take before like a CT scan.
Yeah, or the,
minus the sweet.
Or what they make you drink to get yourself cleared out before a colonoscopy.
Fucking Meyer brand Ovaltine.
Fucking Ready-Clean tastes like absolute trash.
Ugh.
According to the visitors, the drink was what allowed him to go on these journeys with him. In September 1759, Jacob Jacobson, the most unfortunate name, was coming home from delivering food to a farmer when he stumbled upon a wide, flat road that he had never seen before. Curious, he followed it. It led to a grand red mansion. Jacob Jacobson soon found himself sitting on a bench in a large chamber, sitting opposite a small, chubby man in a red hat. Elves and other little people were running around eating and drinking. A beautiful human-sized maiden offered him food and drink, but Jacob sensed it was a bad idea and turned them down. He then asked God to help him get home, which upset the little people so much that they threw him out.
Was that Santa or Satan?
Or gnome. He woke on the shore of a nearby lake, having vanished for 4 days. This is another common theme between alien abductions and the Fae folk. Time seems to work differently. And of course, we remember the story of Joe Simonton and his saltless wheat cakes. All of this phenomena, as great and weird as it is also deeply personal to those involved. Joe Simonton later regretted telling anyone of his experiences because no one believed him. Quote, "It's these details that fascinate me. Why make up such a ridiculous thing if you want to be taken seriously? Why did Cal Nauselin describe the beings as fuzzy, levitating boxes? What's the reason for Bruno Nygaard to even tell about the boys and their flying snuffbox? Lillianne told both the press and investigators that she was offered a piece of chocolate by two aliens. An absurd story by any means." And maybe it is that all of this is highly subjective in nature, that these events occur out of phase with physical reality, somewhere connected to the human consciousness. For example, in 1946, there was a rash of ghost rocket sightings, just post-war, and with the space age fresh in people's minds. Rockets were a growing part of the shared human psychic landscape. Quote, "What's familiar to people, their consciousness merges with. The experience itself becomes a projection of their own existence, whether it's by conditioning through culture and religion, or their own personal experiences and reference points. I'm not saying this is so, but it's a hypothesis that works no matter if you're into folklore, ufology, cryptozoology, or whatever makes your heart beat a little bit extra." So maybe it is that the old adage about taking candy from strangers may somehow have roots in some sort of ancestral memory or folklore. Quote, "Hysteria, dimensional rifts between realities, or spectral projections of the collective consciousness? Elves offering food to a farmhand, aliens offering pancakes to Joe Simonton, aliens offering chocolate to Lillianne, and clowns offering candy to children. It's all so damn similar."
Phantom clowns.
One summer, Vico Tupisala and his fiancée, Lena Manninen, were visiting an island in the Stockholm archipelago. They were joined by their friend Paavo Mäkelä and their dog Maurice. The plan was to drive and then travel by boat to a remote cabin on the island. When they came upon a small bridge, they saw a Volvo on the other side. They pulled over to let it pass and watched it as it approached, and then vanished behind a rise and never reemerge on the bridge. Confused and skeptical, they drove slowly over the narrow bridge, but no Volvo ever came into sight. So they moved on, pushing the weird incident out of their minds. When they arrived at their destination, they began to relax. But that would only last so long, as at 11 p.m. they were aroused by the sound of 2 gunshots outside. They looked out, and there was the goddamn Volvo sitting amidst some birch trees in the distance.
Was the Volvo the shooter?
A car sitting somewhere isn't that weird, except that there were no roads on the island. They watched as it moved deeper into the grove and then vanished. Moments later, they saw a movement as the trees all seemed to be pushed down, the thickest snapping like a matchstick. And not but a few minutes later, slowly the trees began bending back to their original shape. Vecco, during the commotion, got dressed and ran outside with his camera. As he got close to the grove, he noted that the only sign anything had happened was the broken tree, and that their dog acted nervous and growled at the vegetation. The next day, they inspected the site again along with some neighbors, who confirmed that there was no way that the tree had just broken on its own. In a 1977 edition of Flying Saucer Review, a man called the police fearing that he was being surveilled by two men in a black Jaguar. But when the police showed up and approached the car, it suddenly vanished. The area was examined and no explanation could be found. There are other stories, like these, woven throughout UFO lore. Some with vanishing cars, others where it seems that the drivers of a car are suddenly in another realm. Some stories like this we've even covered on the show. British researcher Penny Randles dedicated an entire book to this sort of phenomenon called Time Storms, The Amazing Evidence of Time Warps, Space Rifts, and Time Travel, which the title alone sounds dope. She dubs this phenomenon the Oz Factor, those moments when we are apparently whisked away to another reality. So maybe, in a similar fashion to the Oz Factor, the Volvo was them experiencing the other side of it, where they were seeing somebody else who was lost. In February 1984, Auntie Johnson was on his way home in Tingsryd. It was close to 1 a.m., and there was poor visibility due to snow. Paranoid due to his totally rational fear of hitting a moose, he was surprised to see a short figure walking alongside the road. A little ways on, he noticed something at the far end of a pasture. It was a huge black object, estimated to be 80 meters long and 10 meters high. It looked like a submarine with sloping ends. And it was hovering. Wishing he was from the future so he would have a cell phone, he drove home to get his camera, hoping it would still be there when he returned. He told his wife what was going on and then left to go find the object. Unfortunately, the object was gone. Or fortunately. He drove around looking for it until he was forced to stop by another object hovering over the road. It was smaller, 15 to 20 meters long and 5 to 10 meters high. Slamming on his brakes, his car spun out and stopped just short of the object, but he was close enough to see that it was matte black in color. He then tried to back out, but he lost control and skidded into a snowbank. He looked up to see the object was gone. It had vanished. He felt an urge to flee, but his car was stuck. And when he stepped out to dig the car out, he felt something grab his left arm. It was short and in a hooded cloak. It looked almost cubical in shape. So he thought that maybe this was the man that he'd seen walking along the road. Living through his own nightmare ripped him out of his vehicle as he struggled and screamed.
Ah!
He managed to free himself and started to run for nearby houses, but more creatures stood in his way. They attacked, dragging him away and towards yet another black object. He was fighting them with everything that he could, but he couldn't break free. That is, until a big truck drove by. The headlights caused the creatures to release him and retreat, so he stumbled back to his car and blacked out. When he woke again, he was at Vaxio Hospital.
I mean, that's a reasonable response for your brain to be just like, eh, let's just not form any more memories until we get to a place with lights and people.
Listen, this whole consciousness thing clearly isn't working out for us. Let's just check out.
Yeah, I mean, he probably blacked out because of, like, he was, you know, in an immense amount of fear, finally got to a place where he felt secure and his brain just shut the fuck down.
Yep. That is the thing is when you're taking something to a criminal trial for like an assault case or a robbery like that, you have to factor in too much adrenaline pumping through your body will fuck up your brain's ability to form memories.
Yeah. Over the years, the story has been retold many times with slight variation. But his wife did remember him coming home and telling her about the object. And the police did receive a call from a man introducing himself as Bent Johansson, who claimed to see a car stuck on the side of the road with a black object hovering above it. and he was found white-knuckling his steering wheel in a state of deep shock. This entire area, it turned out, was owned by the Swedish military, and so, naturally, they thought he was spying on them. More interestingly to me, this area is also a bit of a paranormal hotspot. In 1924, a man named Gustav Johansson lived on the edge of the field where the incident later occurred. He reported that there were two prehistoric grave mounds on the property. One day, he tried removing the stones from the mound when he suddenly hallucinated that his entire farm was on fire. He ran home to find no flames. Gustav's brother-in-law was out walking one night when he saw the ember of a cigarette coming closer. As he drew closer, he saw that it was in fact a floating orb which suddenly vanished. Unfortunately for Johansson, his experiences didn't end there, but rather, this was the starting gun to a lifetime of strangeness. He was repeatedly contacted by entities, most human-like, polite, and friendly. Most communications concerned personal matters and his development as a human being. They often brought him gifts of technical equipment and stones, but he was told to keep them to himself as they were meant for him. And this is a theme we see a lot amongst contactees, from tech to vision of a planet's destruction and universal peace and love. Valet has long noted that contactees are different from paranormal witnesses in that they feel that they have some special or ongoing connection to the phenomenon which imparts or reveals some special destiny for them. Both Valet and Keel clearly have negative views of the contactee phenomena, with both at best seeing them as efforts by the UFO intelligence to control or manipulate people. And at the end of the day, as terrifying as the experience was, Ante says that his experience had a net positive impact on him as a person, but he still doesn't really know what it is about, and often questions how real it really is. And with that, we're going to move into discussion question number 4.
Yay!
Okay.
So we have talked time and time again about why people won't believe these kinds of stories. Maybe they're too grand, maybe they're too weird. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. But when it comes to religious experiences, we can see that even those come with struggles to accept. Jesus was murdered by his own people and all. So, do you think it's worth it to go public with these stories, or are they just meant for you? They're just not meant for anyone but you.
I think the question of worth it, I think when we're framing this question, I think we need to kind of come to what is your personal definition of worth it? Because, like, for me, okay, I am fairly confident I know who I am. I know my friends like me, my wife likes me, my family likes me. That's enough for me, ultimately. Like, I love doing the show, I love talking to our fans. If everyone decided next day outside of my immediate friend group that I'm a kook, it won't bother me that much. And that partly because I don't engage in social media that much. So ultimately, I think worth it to me is... it's worth it because, hey, this experience, someone else might share this and this might help them. This might give them some peace to know other people are having this. That is worth it to me. If you're worth it is I want to get more followers, I want to make money, or I want to be respected, then that changes your equation. I think personally these stories should be shared, even if they are, as like John Tenney has suggested, a personal communication. A paranormal experience is the universe talking to you alone, and that it's just for you. And even if that is the case, I still think it's fun to share these because these are fun stories. And especially when you're talking to other people who aren't going to offhandedly disagree with you. I mean, look at the course of this show. We talk about weird shit, but how often has that weird shit led us to talking about very real social issues or about very real psychological issues or emotional issues that are endemic throughout the entirety of our society?
I mean, fairly regularly.
Yeah, and so these conversations, here's the thing, even if you sharing the story won't help us arrive at some grand understanding of what it all means, which who knows, maybe it will, at the end of the day, they're a hell of a conversation starter, and these phenomenon seem to be somehow connected to the core issues of our society. And so, yeah, they're worth talking about. So maybe that makes it worth it to me. Even if nothing else happens, but you get a couple good conversations with some weird people, that's totally worth it.
Yeah.
I I think the decision of if it's worth it or not is determined entirely by the individual, and unfortunately will probably not, they probably won't be able to fully decide if it was worth it or not until after they've made the decision and they've run out of any space to change their minds. I think if I had to offer like a just kind of a general rule from what I've observed, is people seem to, for obvious reasons, seem to have a much better time coping if they only quote unquote go public within certain communities. The people that take their stories to mainstream news outlets and try to like mass publish books with like major publishers, I feel like in general, those people end up overall just having a really shitty time because, getting hate mail sent to their house, and sometimes getting people physically showing up at their house to scream at them and harass them and mock them and all of this other stuff. And I would say in general, that's probably not worth it, just because even if other people see the story and go, oh my God, that happened to me too, the first person still got their life ruined when what they were really hoping for was understanding and validation. Whereas people that go public kind of just within these social spheres are obviously going to have a much easier time finding people who will at least treat them with respect, even if they don't necessarily believe them. And I just don't think, no family deserves to be constantly harassed because dad had a weird experience one time and was so frazzled afterwards he talked to the wrong reporters. And those incidences are often already so traumatic and upsetting for the people that go through them. And a lot of people who experience more mundane traumas often feel like it being made into a public spectacle did not help them in any way, shape, or form. So if I knew somebody who was going through like repeated visitations or a very aggressive haunting or something like that, I feel like I would advise them away from going public in the way that people like Streber and Derenberger and some of the other like really famous contactees went public again in terms of like mainstream news outlets. It's like, I think that's pretty much universally gonna get you the wrong kind of attention, and it's gonna get you a type of publicity and a type of response that is just not gonna help you here.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I sit too. Not necessarily like don't ever go public to the news, but the reality is if you do, go into it with an understanding that your life is, if it gets picked up and it goes like nationwide especially, your life is going to change and it's not going to be for the positive.
Yeah.
Because any kind of, like historically speaking, any kind of situation like that is going to come with haters. It's going to come with people who are going to mock you and this, that, the other thing. That being said, I would encourage people to, on the flip side, to find a place that they would consider a safe space. And if it was, and if they wanted it to be a more public forum, they could do that. So, for example, there are plenty of podcasts out there that do interviews with people to tell their stories, like Jim Harold's Campfire. You could go tell your spooky story over there, and he's gonna just vibe with you about it. Like, that's just what he does. Ultimately, like a show like ours, you could come on and talk to you, and we're not going to fucking hammer you with a bunch of hard-hitting questions that you're not going to be able to answer.
You just had Ollie on.
Right. Like, exactly. Like, that's the, we're just here to listen and, if anything, throw shit at the wall, you know?
Be more like John Mack. I think that's the overall message there.
No, honestly, that's a good one because ultimately, like most people like this, when they're looking to share their story, they just want to be heard and feel like they're not alone.
Yeah. Well, I can say this, having had some of these experiences, I was very fortunate that I had weird friends.
Yeah.
But it is an incredibly isolating experience, even then. Because you find yourself questioning, did this even happen?
Like, yeah.
How do I know that I saw what I saw? And you can talk yourself out of anything like that. I will say this, though. I hope enough people are willing to come forward and share their story that hopefully on enough time, I mean, this is an unproven assertion, but I got to hope over enough time, maybe that will help shift cultural attitudes towards this.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I hope enough people come forward that our show can continue because they keep writing books.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we could probably keep the show going for a cool 2 decades off the book list, the books that we wanted to cover. We will run out eventually.
I don't want to die in this kitchen chair.
Don't worry, we're going to upgrade eventually. You'll die in a rolling chair.
Yay.
Of some sort.
My final thought is this is also one of the situations where whether or not you go public, you have to factor your family into that decision, particularly if you have children.
Like, oh, yeah.
If you have children and they're actively going to school, you maybe shouldn't go to the news with this just because being in middle school is already fucking hard enough. Please at least talk to your kids before you turn your 12-year-old into the guy whose dad sees aliens. Like,
I can agree with that. I will also say I can understand also, though, the thing where some people don't feel like they don't have a choice. Especially look at a lot of the experiencers. Try to really put yourself in the shoes of the people who get taken on the craft and shown a vision of the world engulfed in flames if humanity doesn't change their ways. In my opinion, if you're presented an image like that, at least for me, if that was me, I wouldn't feel like I'd have the moral right to be private about it. I feel like I'd have to at least try, even knowing it's going to ruin my life.
And that's completely fair, and that's when you start getting into the complicated topic of, like, well, am I now a part of the disinformation campaign? Was I shown this so I would go on the news ranting and raving and make this seem even more implausible than it already does? Of, like, we've talked before about ultra-terrestrials seeming to pull pranks just for the hell of it. How do we know that these visions aren't a deliberate attempt to get stupid humans, quote unquote stupid humans, from their perspective, to humiliate themselves in front of their community just because ultra-terrestrials seem to find that funny?
I mean, if John Keel's right, that is exactly what's happened.
And even beyond that, like, even think if you think about it as these are all, if everything is a manifestation of the collective unconscious, humans love to play pranks on each other.
Yes.
Humans love to tease and, almost intentionally or not, humiliate one another for a laugh or not, you know? So intentionally or not, it could just be that, you know? All right. I think we've hit that one pretty hard. You guys got any last things you want to say on that one?
No, I think we're good. I think that we've pounded that one to the dust.
All right. Part 5. It's an owl. No, it's a dragonfly. No, it's a goddamn mystery.
I like that title. But I just wanted to add that. I like that. Good job.
Thank you. This was my first real attempt at naming the titles in a clever way, and I'm enjoying them.
Good. I'm glad that you're entertaining yourself.
Yeah. In the 1980s, a couple, Jorgen Berg and Ulrika Aberg, had just gotten into their car and were preparing to leave for their new home in Maristad. Leaving at 10 p.m., it was a 30-minute drive. At the same moment, they both saw a weird thing hanging over the road. Jorgen saw it as a very large gray sphere with a cone on top. It reflected no light, but seemed to absorb it. A long stem was attached to the top, which rose into the air and out of sight. Ulrika, on the other hand, couldn't see the ball from her perspective. But she did see the stem, which she said had a strange orange and brown glow coming off of it, and said that it seemed to have a pair of dragonfly-like wings on the sides of it, keeping it aloft. The car hit the sphere. The object bounced over the car, and they kept driving. Both of them freaked out, but ended up speaking little of what had just happened. Fred wonders if this was a von Neumann probe, an idea forwarded by German mathematician John von Neumann, which is basically a self-replicating drone. Or maybe it was something prosaic, like a balloon with a weird design. But if so, no further evidence was ever found. But could it also have been an ultra-terrestrial or alien species that was, I don't know, just hanging out? There have been other stories of strange organic objects seen moving about Sweden that would have made Charles Fort proud and probably confused. In 1981, witness Niels Berg and three others had an encounter while on a walk in Uddevalla. They saw an object in the sky that looked like a flat fish with red lights underneath and making the sound of thunder. And another flying fish was seen by farmer Savant Ricola in January 1971. He and his parents noticed a bright object shaped like a fish moving through the sky in a bouncing motion. It stopped near their car, then just took off and vanished. In August of 1980, a man in Stromstad was on his balcony when he saw something like a flying stingray fly past his balcony, going 200 kilometers an hour. It was silver on top and red and blue on the bottom, and moved with wiggling movements. The gods only know what these are. Perhaps all of these things are glimpses of some other world or dimension, a look at something usually hidden to us, or something trying to break through. Owls and UFOs have a growing history. First mentioned in Communion, Strieber saw a white owl looking in through his bedroom windows as a child. And Sweden has plenty of stories like this of its own. First, we have two 15-year-old witnesses in the summer of 1966. They're on their way home, passing through a park that is frequently used as a venue for concerts, dances, and markets. They were a little paranoid as they were riding an illegally modified moped, so they were taking back roads in the hopes of avoiding getting caught. Halfway home, they stopped to pee when one of them saw an owl atop a hay rack looking down at them. One boy aimed the moped's headlight at it, revealing something else. A large silver craft was hanging in the air above them. It began to slowly move off, and they moved to follow it, until they saw it land in a field. The craft was surrounded by a mist. Hiding out of sight the best that they could, they watched it for a moment, and then, suddenly, it took off again and seemed to be moving along the power lines. Quote, "It seemed that the owl was the start of it all, a messenger of some sort. At least if you want to see the experience as something out of the ordinary, which it certainly was for the teenage boys. Seeing owls as an omen of something supernatural happening is common, and further connects the animal, as a symbol or physical being, to the phenomenon in a fascinating way." In Fred's research, he has found numerous cases where witnesses to the anomalous had their experiences while out owl hunting, even if they didn't see any actual owls. One case reported in Galaxian magazine in 1998 tells of an unarmed woman who was out for a bike ride when she noticed a beautiful aurora borealis in the sky. She looked up and saw a large craft, which she called a monster airplane, silently descending towards them. It had an elongated body with protruding nails on the front and a dome on top. It came within 10 meters of them, pointing the large nails at them. Then it turned so that where they could see a large window. Inside, they saw a white, gray alien smiling at them with a lipless mouth.
I don't like that. I don't know why humans get to smile. Nothing else. Anything non-human smiling looks creepy.
Oh, dog smiling is.
Yeah, but that's not really a smile. That's just them panting. It just looks like a smile to us. But intentionally smiling.
I don't know. Looks like a smile to me.
Buffy's pity smile is definitely a smile. She only does it when she's happy.
Yeah, okay. I will believe you guys. You have the pipple. I don't trust Teddy's smile. It's full of deviousness.
Well, he is a trickster himself.
Buffy's smile's just full of teeth.
I'm a shark.
Well, it was only once she was home that she remembered more details of this encounter. She remembered meeting two other beings, one an ugly turtle-like creature with black eyes, and the other looked like a big owl with feather-ish fur and three arms, but no beak.
Get back to the Hundred Acre Woods, you weirdos.
Another case comes from August 1980 with witness Ingvar Oscar Johansson. He was in Sweden visiting his homeland from his new home in Chicago. He and his son were driving along the Swedish coast when he saw a light blue glow lit up the sky. Then a large owl flew up to the front of the car and landed on the car, looking at him with an uncannily human face. It then screamed at him and left. A few miles down the road, he encountered something floating above the road blocking his way. It was a being covered with brown-gray short fur, and it stood on two legs with long ears, a tail, and two horns. Naturally, he thought it was the devil. So he did what anyone from Chicago would do and sped up to hit it with his fucking car. But nothing was there, and he could find no evidence of it on the road behind him as he passed.
Can you imagine that, though? You have seen something truly anomalous, and your first instinct is, I gotta kill this motherfucker.
I can imagine that easily.
Of course you can.
America does something to people.
Look, Jay is a little stabby. I'm just gonna come out and say it. Jay is one of those people who's just looking for the opportunity in life to commit a homicide and not feel bad about it or suffer repercussions.
I don't know if I'd say commit a homicide so much as defend themselves.
That's the thing, I will say the same thing about this that I say about my defense of cannibalism as a survival tactic. I refuse to die out of squeamishness. I refuse to not take the exit offered to me just because I'm gonna have to do something a little bit unsavory to make it out of this situation.
I mean, it's that's good. I mean, you know your limits and that there are none.
So, yeah, basically, if the devil shows up in my house, I am absolutely going, well, it depends on what he's doing.
And it depends on which version of the devil.
Yeah. If it's the robot devil from Futurama, that motherfucker's going down.
Maybe the owl was an omen, warning of the goat man that he was about to see. Maybe not. But Swedish folklore tells of shape-shifting tricksters akin to the Fae, who often took owl form. Quote, a few years ago, my husband went out into the forest during nighttime to look for owls. He saw one sitting on the side of a tree, looking down at him. Can you send me a feather, he thought. And at that same moment, the owl let go of its grasp on the tree, flew over him, and down came a feather. A gift from Magonia, maybe? I choose to believe so. If someone asked me to see a UFO, I'd say either go owl watching or fishing. Embrace the peaceful calm and remember to watch the skies. On November 24th, 1988, a train mechanic named Rune Aspolt was enjoying a cup of coffee in his kitchen when he noticed out the window some strange humanoid shape. It was as tall as a man, dressed in tight silver coveralls with no visible face, and was glowing. He watched as this thing rocked side to side. And as his curiosity got the best of him and he went outside, not taking his eyes off of it, it vanished as soon as he opened the door and left behind no trace that it was ever there. Quote, stories of humanoids have been a tradition in Sweden since way back. Fairies, gnomes, elves, trolls, and other kinds of forest beings are part of our culture. We put all these critters under one umbrella, a småfolk, the little people. While the stories have faded a bit during modern times, they're still around and alive, but far more rare than those of UFOs and ghosts. Fred's grandmother, Julia, was in her early 20s when she arrived in Fagersta in November of 1920. She had come here by train to take a new job as the maid for the local postmaster. Her new employer was only a few kilometers outside of town and was supposed to have sent a carriage to pick her up, but it never arrived. So she walked. Along the road, she encountered a small, grayish being that was standing there waving at her. She called it a tomte, which is a term used for something like a typical gnome, hat and beard included. Curious, she followed it, and ended up leading her to a large house where the creature ran into the yard and vanished from sight. Luckily for her, this was the house that she was looking for. Moments later, the carriage driver appeared, apologizing for missing her at the station. Funnier still, that's the man that she ended up marrying and in turn creating the entire line of people that led to our author's existence. All thanks to a gnome.
I wish I had a cool backstory like that. Like, my conception was due to the mischief of a gnome.
Right?
That's cool as shit.
No gnomes were involved in the creation of Jay, as far as I know.
As far as you know.
Just demons.
I'd buy that.
This is another trope that you see a lot of. Small men who appeared and vanished mysteriously. The 60s and 70s are full of stories of this nature. In February 1971, Ake Westerberg was waiting for a bus when he saw a small man standing atop a nearby snowbank with a small square box attached to his belly. A bright light shone from the box, forcing Ake to turn away, and when he could look again, the creature was gone. Recent events put an entire island in the outer archipelago into hysterics. The entire population of the island had, at different times, seen a huge figure walking out by the water carrying an old-fashioned lantern. Some saw the light as an off-fire red color like an ember. Another witness reported fainting in terror when he ran across the lantern man on the beach. He said it wasn't the sight of it, but some sort of strange primal impulse.
Stingy Jack?
Maybe.
And this lantern man, while oddly eerie, is merely one example in a much larger tradition of mysterious entities carrying odd light. The point being here that there are so many stories that are similar in nature. Aspects of the lore around UFOs seems to grow as others write and theorize about the phenomenon. Is it our cultural frameworks around the phenomenon fundamentally shaping these experiences? And with that, we are actually going to stop for discussion question number 5.
Yay!
Okay.
So, owls, food, gods, saucers, minerals, magnetic fields, and more. We seek out and look for connections from event to event. Pattern recognition, it is the natural way that we work. But in regards to the phenomenon, how much of these patterns do we find because we ourselves begin to attribute them as patterns, essentially saying, if someone didn't theorize that owls were an omen, would we stop seeing them in that way? Would owls stop being present?
Oh, that's a hard one.
I mean, I think perception is a big part of this, and it's difficult to tell. It's difficult to tell correlation and causation when it comes to these things that are treated as you know, omens of visitation, omens of the paranormal. So I think it's very difficult to tell when you have to approach things from a non-materialist standpoint. It's very difficult to tell what is just the power of suggestion from our own pattern seeking brains and what is a legitimate pattern. Like, again, we were talking about the previous episode with Men in Black of, it's like, well, is this real, or like, is this an objective phenomenon, or are we just noticing certain similarities among a disconnected group of mentally ill people having strange encounters out in the world? It's really complicated, because at the same time, we look for those patterns because we're very good at finding patterns. We're very good at picking up on patterns, and we're very good at making inferences about our environment from those patterns. That's all an almanac is understanding patterns of, it's just like, yeah, this is the rainy season because this is the time of year when it rains, or the fact that, you know, technically gray clouds are an omen of it raining. We just have materialist science to back up that, yes, gray clouds have a direct correlation with rain and often indicate that there will be rain. And then there's the extra layer of us creating these things with our mind and putting these things into the world with our mind with such frequency and intensity that they do become less subjective and more objective reality. So I do think there is a distinct possibility that if we all agreed, yeah, no, owls aren't omens of UFOs anymore. Owls have nothing to do with the phenomenon. We probably would stop seeing owls, or we would probably at least get less reports of owls associated with those things. Because again, like we talked about, before, our brains filter shit out all the time if it deems it irrelevant. So if we all somehow as an entire species just collectively agree that it's like, if you see an owl 10 minutes before you have a UFO encounter, that's a coincidence. The owls don't mean anything. We'd probably at least stop getting reports of seeing owls before UFOs, because people would be like, yeah, that's an owl. It doesn't have anything to do with this. It's not relevant. So I'm not going to remember that I saw the owl, or I'm at least not going to repeat the fact that I saw the owl. Like, you know, nobody seems to report that tying their shoes has any sort of correlation with the phenomenon, because, you know, tying your shoes is very clearly irrelevant to us.
It's kind of like that whole thing of 100% of people who drink water have died.
Yep.
Like,
kind of exactly of it's, I think we're unfortunately in a situation where, at least right now, it's probably nearly impossible to tell what is a legitimate observable pattern from which we can extrapolate inferences, if not conclusions, and what is just our brain going, that cloud looks like a face.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So this is actually something that we talk about in next week's Midnight Chats with Fred Anderson. And it's a question that I find myself thinking about an awful lot, especially when I start entertaining ideas about, like we've discussed, like that these things are somehow an externalized projection of collective consciousness, of our psyche.
That was kind of like where my brain was when I was thinking about the question.
So the question then becomes, though, is what agency do these things actually have? Because if they are just literally like a mirror of our collective psyche, the answer would be not much, theoretically. But then you start getting into, if you want to go in two directions, there's the hyper-idealism format, in which case, yeah, they have as much agency as we do because they're thought forms and so are we. Even just because we created them doesn't mean that they don't have an agency of their own. Now, that said, under that model, or under the model of they are something like ultra-terrestrial that our brains can't conceive of, in both situations, I could see the owl image being more like a useful visual overlay. Like, okay, I see a gray. My brain is not ready for that. I see big black glossy eyes. Owls have big black glossy eyes. No nose. Owls kind of have that flat-faced look. No lips. Owls kind of don't have lips. The silence of the craft. Owls fly silently. So I could see almost being, I see a gray. My brain can't accept that due to ontological shock, or maybe I'm literally seeing something my hardware is not configured to perceive. And so I take the elements I can perceive. My brain goes, I know what happens when you put black eyes plus flat face plus no lips together in silent movement. You get an owl. It's an owl. And so it almost becomes a placeholder for the ineffable, for something that we can't quite wrap our head around. And I could see it going both ways, because, again, I don't know what these are. It could be that these are just reflections of our own inner state, and owl has become symbolic to grays, and if we change that culturally, it will change. I'd be very interested and a little frightened if we did somehow mass change the culture and that didn't stop. because that means that there's something else going on there. Either A, the owl is a useful costume that these things are intentionally using, or, like I said, it is the closest we can get to something we cannot comprehend.
So I just used the owl as an example. I was saying in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Patterns, and because we do this with a lot of things within, like, ufology and everything. You know, we've talked about it a million times. We like to put things into neat little boxes, and then to try and explain things, we look for patterns. And then in a very John Keel way, it's like, because we've attributed this pattern or these lines that we think that we've seen, after that is when we start seeing more and more, like the green car, like, you know, green or blue car syndrome or whatever the fuck it's called. We see that in examples outside of the paranormal. So it's like, if that's the case, and, you know, prior to Strieber, we never really saw owls as these things representing UFOs. And it's only after Strieber that now we're seeing it all the time. So, I guess, like, is it, you know, like I was saying, like, is it because of that we are seeing it that way? And I think, to an extent, yes, right? Assuming in a very more, I guess, idealistic model, yes, of course, it has to be, right? But I think Nick, I like the way that you put it, and I think that's the reasoning that we would do it if there is some kind of external aspect to it. I think the reasoning is because maybe it's our brain trying to filter it through. Like, one of the stories that we just went through was the kids on the moped, and they saw the owl until they shined the light on it, and then it was a craft. So was the owl a warning, or was it a filter? I tend to think it was probably more of a filter in that situation, that they were seeing an owl because that's what they could rationalize. As the light hit and their eye, almost like their brain started to focus on it more, then it became something else.
Well, so if you think about our experience of the world, this is not my metaphor. I know other ufologists have used this before. Think of our perception of the world like your computer desktop, right? So a Word document on the desktop, you see that little symbol, you see the title of it, and that symbol lets you know that is that document, right? But it is not the document itself. Almost in the sense of, like, the owl is the desktop icon for the craft. And on a cursory glance in the background on your surface level desktop, that's exactly what it is. It's not till you open the file, till you focus your attention upon it, that you actually see, hey, this thing that I thought was my school assignment is in fact raunchy fan fiction. Right? It's not until you dig into it that you start, don't look at me like that, Jay, until you start, till you can see what the actual content is. You need to give it your will, your focus. Otherwise, it fades into the background, and in the background, your background processes turn it into whatever it needs to assign the least amount of brain power towards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, are we ready to go into the last part?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I'm done talking about owls for now, though I do love the topic.
I am a fan of them as well.
They're noble birds.
Angry, fluffy throw pillows.
I like that description better than mine.
All right. Part 6. We are built on stories.
Yay!
Oh, that's a good title. I like that.
Very nice title.
Our author has always been interested in UFO hoaxers, such as the man who wanted to believe, Gray Barker. In 1956, he released They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, which was the first book to deal with the Men in Black phenomenon, sparking a whole new side of the mythology that branches out into a famous movie franchise. Another example of fiction becoming reality comes from Robert Anton Wilson, who, along with Robert Shea, wrote the Illuminatus trilogy, which created the idea of the Illuminati in popular culture. Wilson was then flabbergasted later when he was contacted by a representative of the organization that he'd help invent. Similarly, Alan Moore claimed to have encountered his character John Constantine in a bar. These are fascinating and baffling stories that, like so many others heard here today, are almost too weird to make up. It's almost as if their cultural impact, or maybe the impact the character or idea had on them, left an indent on the mind of society and made them real. Or maybe they were manifested because of the effort that was put into their creation, like a tulpa, egregore, or other thought form. In 1955, three lumberjacks, one of which is named John LaFontaine, saw a cigar-shaped object flying haphazardly above the tree line before it crashed and created a powerful vacuum, pulling everything toward it. The three men approached and found the body of a small, well-built man wearing a reddish metal uniform. He had yellowish skin, deep-set black eyes, and his clothing looked to have been glued to his skin. The body had a rectangular object in its hand, which had 12 small indents on it. These lumberjacks saw the man engage with the item, then toss it away, warning them not to touch it, and he said this all in perfect Swedish. It claimed to be from the vicinity of the constellation that we know as Eagle. He was one of several races to visit their home, most of which were so advanced that we couldn't see them unless they decided to materialize, which is a likely story. The creature was dying and gave the men a folded bag with an invisible pocket, instructing them to put him in the bag and take him out to the river, which, if they were hoping for a Green Lantern ring, they were sadly disappointed. He said the bag and his body would vanish. Afterwards, they should all wash themselves thoroughly to avoid getting sick. It then died, and the men carried the body in the bag, which smelled of sulfur and burned their hands to the touch. When they set it in the water bubbled with some kind of chemical reaction, and then the body and bag dissolved. Fred tracked the source back to a tabloid called UFO Universe, which was edited by the notorious Timothy Green Beckley, a known hoaxer who didn't seem to care if his magazine printed fact or fiction, which Alan Greenfield, who knew Beckley, later confirmed. He also found that John LaFontaine was an alias based off of older Swedish folklore. While perusing the archives for The Unexplained, Fred found a 1977 edition of a Swedish UFO magazine that had printed John LaFontaine's story. This would be far earlier than the 1991 article and likely represented the original source for the tale. This version revealed the actual location of the event to be in Kristina, a hippie community in Sweden, who were disbanded, and in the aftermath, some of the members formed a UFO group led by Steen Lanzi, who were the ones to publish the 1977 magazine. When Fred reached out to Lanzi, he confirmed that LaFontaine was an employee volunteer at the group during that time. He had no idea where John was now or if he was alive. Someone on Facebook in a Swedish UFO group claimed to have known LaFontaine and said that he was a storytelling master who traveled around Denmark lecturing on UFOs before he'd passed away. LaFontaine, as it turned out, wasn't the witness, but he was the author who was reporting the story that he had been told by the witness. The actual witness was in his 60s at the time and has very likely passed away by now. The truth is that we'll never know the truth of this one. Everyone involved is either dead or unidentified or both. Quote, "This is what ufology is about, at least partly. Storytelling, imagination, a delicate walk on the fine line between truth and fiction. Stories like this belong as much in the UFO culture as Tic Tacs, bright dots in the sky, contactees, abductees, field investigators, and boring, office-bound researchers like me." In his research, Fred repeatedly encountered stories which ended up being internet hoaxes, including a pterodactyl creature near Helen Lake and the monster of Almora Swamp. However, when he looked into a story about a wild man he had heard on a podcast, Historier från Hälsingland, about an encounter with a group of wild men in 2002, he was surprised to find some glimmers of truth therein. Specifically, two historical cases complete with witness names, dates, and locations. On February 27, 1977, reindeer herder Niels Thomas Laba was out on his snowmobile near his home in Sapporo, looking for a lost reindeer. He was near a lake when he saw four people dressed in brown clothes walking on ice towards him. When they noticed him, they turned left and completely vanished into a vibrating, transparent cloud that floated into the air.
That's a great way to leave a conversation, just as general. Awkward talk, just turn right? mist.
I love the occasional UFOs that appear to just be clouds. I love the idea of non-human entities traveling via cloud. It's like, is it white and fluffy in there, or do you have seats and a console? Like, what? Like, I will willingly enter that UFO just out of sheer curiosity. And that's how they get me for the Lanulos Zoo.
See, here's the thing. It does also make me think about the fact that most ancient cultures, the gods came from the skies. They flew on clouds.
Yep.
Yep.
Like, it's a little alarming.
The elephant god Ganesha travels via mouse.
In August 2005, witness Henrik Stromberg Krohn and his friend were out fishing when they met two silent men dressed in old-fashioned clothes wandering on the deserted roads. They had no gear with them and seemed to vanish as quickly as they had arrived. Quote, "What I find interesting is how similar stories, both clearly made up and those based on reality, show up, like the opposite sides of the same coin, reflections of events and distorted mirrors of reality." Alan Greenfield wrote in Saucers and Saucerers that the UFO phenomenon exists on the borderline between reality and imagination, and as such do not lend themselves to rational analysis. Perhaps reality is merely another dream state, which we phase into and out of. And Fred believes that experiencing the phenomenon involves silencing the mind and stepping beyond the materialistic worldview to, in effort, become a liminal space unto yourself. Vuk from the podcast Tracing Owls posited that liminal spaces may be gateways or passages between outside reality and the collective unconscious, which he equates to the Jungian archetypes. To Fred, if there is a universal mind, and we are part of it, then it must be downright insane, which is good. A sane mind is typically not very imaginative. Quote, "The phenomenon is a six-armed ape tripping balls on acid while throwing feces around, and those getting too close will get hit in the face. That's basically what I think it's all about. Chaos. There lies the key to studying the phenomenon. Keep your balance and don't go too deep into the rabbit hole." For every one story that gets the smallest bit of attention, there is likely hundreds, if not thousands, of others that will never be told. Large in part due to the social stigma attached to having the experience, especially in the wake of communion. The media looks at it as a mental health issue, and most UFO researchers are desperately, desperately trying to be taken seriously. We can see this in modern ufology with its intense focus on military witnesses, trained observers, and national security concerns. They can claim that UAP is a more accurate term all they want, but the renewed use of the term UAP is just a form of hiding behind a new term to avoid mockery. To Fred, the price of ending stigma has been the degeneration of imagination. Fred has far more respect for those who embrace their weird experience and proclaim it to the world, no matter how strange. The Joe Simontons with their wheat cakes. Think about Alan Moore's idea of an idea space. It's an inner reality which can manifest itself outwardly within shared imagination. It's how a concept like Star Trek spreads through the minds and mythologies of those who encounter it, living in their brains rent-free for their whole lives. Quote, "It's a reality of its own, just existing through, for example, fan fiction. What I create in my mind is real. It's just not physical in the way that I'm used to. It takes on a life of its own when mixed with the imagination of others. Ideas are explored, worked with, debated, put aside, embraced, or dealt with in any other way. It's the collective consciousness at work for good or bad." Maybe the phenomenon is part of us. It wants to be seen and for us to interact with it. There is no doubt that it is, as many have noted, a trickster that seems inherently playful even when it's sinister. But this is yet another element which exists in the stigma within the stigma, which ostracizes the woo. UFOs, Bigfoot, psychic powers. It's all the same, just with a different face. We are looking at us, and we are looking back, the observer and the observed. What we see is a dreamlike reflection of our own past, a perception viewed through the experiences and information that we've consciously or unconsciously received since we were born. Medieval alchemists called this reality the aether. Quote, our consciousness is a whole universe by itself, a sparkling mind sky of infinite stars. Of course, we're not alone there. One day, a strange visitor might come knocking on your existence with a delicious gift. The question will be, as it always has been, if you will accept it or not. And that will lead us into our final discussion question.
I really liked that segment of the book.
Me too. It was far and away my favorite section of the book. For our final question, I want us to look at the modern UFO explosion with this push for disclosure and truth. Let's assume that the government does know with certainty what it is, and that it does have to do with consciousness, that we are in some way the source of the phenomenon. Why not just say that? Why hide under the guise of national security when historically there hasn't been much in the way of threatening action?
I mean, this is the million-dollar question right now. If there is no there, why the cover-up? And if there is a there, why do you feel the need for a cover-up? Now, I've heard a lot of arguments, and I could understand some of them. But in terms of, like, if it is consciousness-based, well, let's look back to when if the current timeline that is commonly accepted within ufology is the real one. When did the cover-up first start? The 1930s. That's a very different world than it is today. And in that world, you're coming into, I don't know, there you have a lot more religiosity. You have a lot, I mean, religion is a much bigger part of the everyday experience. Communities are much smaller. They're more insular. I could see the argument being made that we can't, space aliens alone, that challenges the current paradigm of reality. But then you start adding in all this other stuff. You say, well, yeah, but they aren't just from another planet. They're from another plane of existence. They are the biblical angels. They might even rewrite our understanding of religion. And that's not saying that's true, but that could be something they would fear would get extrapolated. I think if you go back then, you're looking at the post-war World War I world. World War II is on the horizon, or it's just happened, depending on when the cover-up happened. I could see the idea being this is simply too weird, and it will cause too much chaos in a time when everyone just wants stability. And so I could see that being why it was initially covered up, and it kind of one of those situations where that decision just got grandfathered again and again and again because no one knew or wanted to be the guy to have that conversation with the public. I mean, because even today, if it came out today that, yeah, these exist and they are connected to consciousness and our understanding of reality is wrong, A, you'd have a large swath of people who simply wouldn't be able to handle it and wouldn't believe it. And then you'd have another swath of people, unfortunately, and I think this was hammered home to me over the last several years, who would take that and say, okay, well, you are wrong about reality. So clearly you're wrong about everything else. And, you know, it's basically anything that's accepted truth becomes negotiable, which already there's people who are acting that way. So I could very much see the reason why you wouldn't want disclosure. Now, that said, there's all the other options. Like, what if there is some technology piece there and it will greatly disrupt, say, the oil economy? It will greatly disrupt existing industries. Governments prefer things to be boring and stable, and a world in which entities from our shared psychic space can pop in here and abduct people or talk to them or cook them pancakes, it's unstable. It's not a world where everyone is going to be comfortable getting up every day, going to their job, and not wondering about the nature of the universe. You know, I think that there is an urge, and I think this runs through government. I think this runs through religion. I think that this runs through our culture to want to believe that basically we're done. We've learned all the mysteries. Yes, there's some weird extra deep science stuff we don't know yet, but that will be figured out in time. There's this assumption that the ineffable is dead.
And I think the sudden revelation that not only is it not dead, but it is just as unknowable now as it was then, or it's still in this space that's completely beyond our mechanisms of knowing, of how we understand things, of how we get to an understanding of them. I think that that is a very, very scary idea for a huge amount of people. Because I think one thing we have to accept is that, well, we hear that news and we would be like, ha, cool. Like, we are not the majority of the population. Our listeners are not the majority of the population. Most people, and I don't think about these things, they're still at the, hey, the government is talking about having little gray men in sci-fi craft. And that's, again, that's not saying that that might not be the case. But can you imagine then trying to get a billions of people to wrap their head around the fact that, yeah, no, not only is that not the case, it's so wrong that your base assumption above reality is wrong. It would be chaos. And while it might be more accepted in Eastern cultures, in the West, which, you know, again, is what our government cares about, I think it would cause a huge, huge ripples that we couldn't really even foresee. And I think the fact that they can't even predict the kind of impact it would have on our culture and our society means that they are terrified of it.
But I think they can.
I don't know.
Historically, I mean, what we're talking about is effectively the reality of a lot of people of like faiths, religions, the actions, because a lot of these similar actions have been prescribed to the same kind of entities and beings, right? How have they reacted?
Yeah, I think that here's the thing, though. I don't think anyone's taking it. If people are taking a step back and actually doing that analysis, it's not getting to the people at the top. And I think the people at the top, when they're confronted with the enormity of the task, simply don't want to be the guy to do it. Because, again, it's a very human thing. I don't want to do this thing that's too big because I don't want to be the guy that messes it up.
Yeah.
Especially considering, I mean, if the revelations were about consciousness, that is a paradigm change that, in my opinion, would be greater than the Enlightenment, greater than the Renaissance. It would be a complete restructuring of basal reality for many people.
Is that such a bad thing?
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying if I was a government official, I want things to be status quo forever.
I think you hit the nail on the head for what I would consider part of the problem.
Oh,
The fact that our government officials want everything to remain the status quo, they want everything, and for some, they want it to go backwards. So why would they want to talk about anything that has the potential for evolving our social consciousness?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, typically governments do not keep things secret out of fear of upsetting their population due to actual concern for us. Pretty much if a government is hiding something, it's because they feel like it's going to undermine whatever authority they currently hold over their constituents and citizens. So my guess would be if they know about the phenomenon, they have proof about the phenomenon, and they have proof that it is a consciousness-based thing, that for some reason they are keeping that back because it is going to destabilize whatever authority they presently hold over us. Most likely because, again, they're already kind of struggling with us living in like a quote-unquote post-truth society. And yeah, I feel like if you find out that you know, you can generate tangible physical beings just from your mind, and that there are these things that crawl out from our subconscious and have agency and the ability to hurt you and affect things in their environment, I just feel like the root concern is the destabilization of our society that would ensue after that. And also, humans really don't like it when they find out their government has been keeping something from them for just about any reason. So at this point, they might be in a situation of, we've been lying about it for too long. We can't tell them everything we've done to keep them from finding out about this. And the minute we tell them
that this is real, the follow-up questions are going to be, what did you know and when did you know it?
Yeah, and I think that that's also a very real possibility. And, I mean, again, you come back to someone made a decision however many years ago, and it just gets grandfathered over and over again. And every time it's grandfathered and the can is kicked down, the inevitable blowback when it does come out gets bigger because the secret gets bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of becomes one of those situations of no one wants to do it because it's too hard, and it gets harder every time they don't do it.
It's like telling your kid they're adopted. It's like, just don't. Well, when do I tell my kid? Immediately, from the second they come home. Let it just be a fact forever.
Hiding, lying, obfuscating, things that have a large impact on you as a person has never worked.
No.
And it never will work, because ultimately hiding, obfuscating, or any of that to the individuals or individual that are on the other side of it will always look like a lie.
Always.
Even if it's not necessarily a lie, they will see it and accept it as if you lied to them.
Yeah, no human being truly, no rational human being that hasn't been brainwashed or abused genuinely believes that something can be kept from them for their own good.
Right.
Of it's like, I heard this one horrible story about this person who, when they were growing up, they weren't told that their mother was dying of cancer until she had 48 hours to live.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah. That is genuinely unthinkable to
me. Yeah, her parents actively kept it from her that her mom was going to chemo and receiving radiation therapy. Like, she was just told something about why her mom wasn't there.
Like, I can see, like, that is going to come down to they didn't want it to impact her day-to-day and blah, blah, blah. But all they did, like this, just kick the can down the road and make the trauma that much worse,
mm-hmm.
ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the government likely has some idea of what they think is going on, or one aspect of what they think is going on with... when it comes to all of this. But I don't ever think that in the way that the way that the United States specifically, I'm not going to speak for other countries, the way that the United States approaches politics and all of the other things that are happening, especially right now in our country, the odds of us seeing disclosure in our lifetime are zero.
At least full disclosure.
I don't think they're going to say anything, because there's already senators that were on the side of disclosure pushing against talking about it again.
Yeah.
Like, the burial is beginning again. Like, and ultimately, and I think it's because they don't want to come off looking like idiots.
Yeah.
And nothing that they say here is going to make them look smart, because nobody knows anything, including them.
And yeah. It's very likely that anyone contributing significant amounts of money to their campaign is going like, listen, man, I've invested a lot in making sure you remain a senator. So this alien shit, I need you to shut the fuck up.
Even if that wasn't the case, even if that is happening, it's about to be an election year.
Yeah.
And that's always an excuse to not talk about things that are quote unquote hard to talk about. But also the Republican Party is collapsing inside of itself, and they're turning more conservative. So
yep.
They're not going to ever talk about UFOs if that means that they're going to progress societal consciousness. No, because that's going to put their ideals at the bottom of the barrel. And the Democrats are too all over the place right now to do anything.
Yeah, because the Democrats are trying to figure out, it's like, okay, how gracefully are we going to handle the transition from the Progressive Party to the Conservative Party when the Republican Party just inevitably becomes a far-right terrorist organization?
Yeah. So I don't, unfortunately, I'm not sure that there is a good outcome here. But like when it comes to like the idea of why hide under the guise of national security, and the answer to me is very simple, because then they don't have to talk about it.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately has a ring of truth to it.
Yeah, they can just say that it's a purpose of national security and then be done with it, and that's the end. And unfortunately, it's sad, and as sad as it is, I think that's where we're going to be right now. And prove me wrong, government, that would be cool, but I don't see it happening.
Imagine if tomorrow Biden comes shuffling out to the podium in front of the White House in his bathrobe. He looks exhausted and he's like, all right, you know what? I'm tired. And I'm tired of being told I haven't done anything for this country. So here you go. And he just fucking pulls a like gray out from behind a shrub and it's going, Joe, this can't be how we do this.
I love the idea that like that gray didn't know this was coming. It was already in the shrub. And because Biden knew where it was, presumably it's been there for a while.
He pulls the gray out of the shrub. The gray is holding a cigarette in one hand and a lighter in the other and looks baffled and embarrassed. If it's like, I came out here so no one would smell the smoke.
I mean, like I said, I have to have hope that maybe in my lifetime there'll be a sea change, because there are major forces for change and major cultural things that are changing in our country very slowly, but it's happening. For better or worse, that's a good question. But, you know, so maybe something will slip out. Maybe there will be a victory. Maybe it will get pushed back under. At the end of the day, though, I think what happens is very indicative, is very dependent on how weird the truth is. And, you know, and I mean, obviously, based on what you were saying, also how much they actually do know about it. Because they don't know anything. You're right. They won't say anything because they don't want to be, they don't want to project a sense of powerlessness, especially America. It's pathologically ingrained in our country by this point. But if it is super weird, maybe there will be a good whistleblower who we can all share a bunch of classified documents, go to prison, and we can spend the rest of our time arguing on UFO forums about that guy's testimony. Or maybe something grander will happen. I certainly hope it will be something grander.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, and also we do have to, you know, also add in, even though it hasn't happened so far, there is always the caveat of, it might not be wholly in their hands. It might be, then there's a chance that what if one day the others, whatever they are, decide to pull the trigger for them?
Yeah. Assuming that there are others.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right. I think that's it.
I
think with that, we can close the book on Northern Lights, High Strangeness in Sweden by Fred Anderson.
I like the book. Go out and read it. And make sure you tune in next week for our interview with Fred Anderson. And for the week after, stay tuned for the, we'll be announcing the actual time of the live stream.
As we get a little bit closer
to
it.
Where we are going to be doing the ritual of the Kringle.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. I made it up right now. I think that's it though.
I mean, other than the about the author, you got to read.
Oh, right.
I hope the Santa that shows up from our Estes Method isn't the one from Candy Cane Lane. That was a really disappointing Santa.
Yeah, fun enough movie, but yeah.
I didn't watch it. I have no interest in seeing it.
You would hate it.
Yeah, I don't think you'd like it.
It would do nothing for you.
That's like, kind of what I figured.
I need to find, like, on YouTube a supercut of the unhinged elf scenes and just show those to you, because Pepper is hysterical. The rest of the movie is happening.
Are we ready for the about the author?
Please.
Fred Anderson is a researcher, television freelancer, author, and podcaster in Sweden who is known for out-of-the-box thinking and explorations of the strange. He's appeared on a great number of Swedish radio programs, magazine articles, and newspapers. He has worked on a number of award-winning documentaries and programs in Sweden, including Det Okanda and Spokjakt, which is not correct. I did not pronounce any of those right. He has written two other books called Homo Satanus and Homo Satanus II, The Devil Made Me Do It,
which details his childhood and how it led to the adoption of what he calls cheerful Satanism. He also often posts on Medium about his ongoing research and related topics, and he is also an artist, painting, you guessed it, UFOs, MIBs, and other figures of high strangeness. And that's it.
Awesome.
That's all I could find.
And some of that we go into a little bit more, specifically the Satanist bit, next week.
Yep.
With that, are we ready for housekeeping?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping. So,
if you liked what you heard, please like and subscribe on whatever podcasting platform it is that you are listening to us on. And if it is Apple or Spotify, please leave us a review. 5 stars preferred, but not required.
Do it.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that. Noctivagantpodcast@gmail.com or on social media at NoctivagantPod on Twitter. And I'm at Mix Rory Wicks.
I'm at Bearish Terror.
I'm at Midwest Undead.
And then we have more social medias, an Instagram, Noctivagant_podcast.
A Reddit account, Noctivagant Podcast.
And a Tumblr account, Noctivagant Podcast.
As you can see, there is in fact a theme. It's like our name. But
yes.
I think that's it.
I think so. So lead us out of here, Rory.
Good night, ghosties. Good night, ghoulies. Good night, moth people. Stay safe out there on those midnight roads.
Don't get lost.
Don't trust the government officials on the road.
That's true.
But you can trust the fuzzy box.
I'll agree with that.
Just a cheerful little box man going about his boxy business.
Before he returns home to his gray spouse. Break and put him on like a suit.
For trying to hit supernatural entities with our car, do you think that UFOs try to hit us with their flying saucers?